This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Welcome back to Epistemics. We are joined once again with Hamza Dortez. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Okay, bro. Habibi. Let's quickly move on. The problem of evil. That's what I want to talk about today.
It's not a problem.
Okay, why isn't it a problem?
It's not a problem because it doesn't make sense. But before we argue why it doesn't make sense as an argument against God or as some kind of position that undermines theism, we have to discuss what is the problem of evil.
Okay, so why don't you summarize for us what the problem of evil is?
Okay, well, the problem of evil can be summarized in the following way. A popular conception of it can be summarized in the following way. It is unbelievable, which really means highly unlikely. Mm. It is highly unlikely that a good, which can also include a loving, a merciful, etc., a good and all-powerful God exists with all of the evil and suffering that happens and occurs in the world.
Okay. And so expound upon that a bit. So explain.
Okay, what they're basically saying is, well, if God is genuinely good, he's maximally perfect, his names and attributes are to the highest degree possible, so his goodness is to the highest degree. Mm-hmm. He is loving, he is merciful. Then surely he doesn't want evil and suffering to occur.
Yeah.
Right? They're saying, well, since it does occur, then we may have to question his goodness. Right? Okay. Or on the other hand, since it does occur, and we try and maintain the fact that he's still good and merciful, then we have to question his power.
Okay.
Because if he's good, he wants evil to stop, but if he doesn't stop the evil, then maybe he doesn't have the power.
Right. Okay.
So on this argument, they basically say that it's unbelievable or highly likely that a good and all-powerful God exists with all of the evil and suffering in the universe. And they come out with some kind of emotional arguments, like, you know, how dare he, you know, kids die and there's cancer. And you know, let's be very honest. Mm. I think we have to be honest that parts of life is suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the unique things about the Islamic tradition is that it accepts that because life is a test. You're not here to boogie. It's not a party.
Yeah.
That's paradise. Yeah. And we have to accept the fact that we're going to be tested with suffering. And sometimes it's the type of suffering that we can't really explain emotionally, right? Mm-hmm. And the unique thing about the Islamic tradition, it gives us the tools, existential, spiritual, etc., tools to transcend suffering by giving the right meaning to suffering. But that's another discussion we can have. So that's the argument in a nutshell.
So
it's a flawed argument.
Okay, so this is what I want to do today. People have heard you break down this argument, right? You've written about it, your essays are there, I'll link it in the description below. I want you to briefly break down the whole argument quickly, but what I really want to focus is on what you just mentioned.
Okay.
Is those real practical tools that Islam gives you to deal with life, basically. I think that's going to be far more impactful for the people that are watching this. But before even both those things, there's one more thing I want to quickly touch upon. You know, this whole argument of the whole problem of evil, they throw this against God and say, therefore, God does not exist. Mm. How does that fit into the puzzle? Right? There's one thing addressing the problem of evil, but does the problem
They're saying your conception of God doesn't exist.
Right,
Because we don't just say God exists. We say, well, he's powerful and he's merciful. Mm. Okay, well, that God doesn't exist.
But it doesn't deny God's existence.
Well, it doesn't deny a creator.
Yeah.
So in the Islamic tradition, this wouldn't undermine the kind of the rububiyyah of Allah, meaning the creative power of God, that he's the only unique creator, sustainer, maintainer, and owner of everything that exists.
Yep.
What it does is attacking the other aspect of tawheed, oneness of God in the Islamic tradition, which is the tawheed of asma wa sifat, the names and attributes, because we believe God is al-bar, he's the source of all goodness, he's al-Rahman, he is the intensely merciful, he is al-wudud, he is the loving, and so forth and so on, and he is the powerful. It's attacking that aspect of his oneness, right? The one of affirming the oneness of the divine. And in this context, it's his names and attributes, or you could say in a kind of general way, his nature. So they would argue, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it. Yeah. You don't just believe in an abstract kind of creator, you know, that, you know, or you're not a deist, that you just believe in a creator and then he just gave you the... He's a landlord that gave you the keys and ran away. Yeah. That's not the creator that you believe in. You actually give him names and attributes. Mm-hmm. He's good and he is loving and he's merciful. That God can't exist.
Okay.
by virtue of the level of evil and suffering in the world. Mm-hmm. But that's still a false argument.
Okay. And this is the, so this moves me on to the next point, because in your book, for example, or in this particular chapter on the problem of evil, you mentioned that there are some daring assumptions.
Yeah. Well, it's not just me, but it's other philosophers, Christian and other philosophers mm-hmm. that have really responded to the atheist critique here. Mm-hmm. And basically that the problem of evil and suffering argument has two daring assumptions. Number one, that God is only good and all powerful. Mm-hmm. And number two, that Allah hasn't given us any good reasons or any reason why he's allowed evil and suffering in the first place. Because what they've done, they've abstracted away God's names and attributes from the rest of his names and attributes. Mm-hmm. So they've taken goodness and power, mm-hmm. and they remove them from all the other names and attributes of the divine in the Islamic tradition and other theistic traditions. Yeah, mm-hmm. So they're like, okay, let's ignore God. Let's just take just two of his attributes, mm-hmm. right?
And make
them, and then attack them. Mm-hmm. But what you're doing, you're building a straw man.
Yep.
You're actually attacking a straw man. You've misrepresented God in our tradition, because in our tradition, Allah is not only good and all powerful, mm-hmm. he's also the wise, he's al-hakim, he's al-alim, he is the wise, he is the knowing, and so forth and so on. And so on and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. So, and in the Islamic tradition, we don't see his names and attributes in abstraction, in mm-hmm. isolation. We see them via his oneness. Mm-hmm. Do you see? Mm-hmm. So, they've built a straw man of the divine.
Mm. Why do you think they do that?
I think they don't understand the theism properly.
So what do you think they're basing that on?
Like, but what's important, yeah. before you ask that question, what's important is to say, well, when we include the fact that Allah is al-Hakim, mm-hmm. when we include the fact that Allah is al-Alim, mm-hmm. he is the wise and he is the knowing, it undermines the whole argument.
How?
Because, okay, he's good and powerful, mm-hmm. but he's also the wise.
Okay.
So if evil does happen, we know there is a wisdom behind this goodness. And if there is a wisdom, that means there is a reason. Mm. So, and that wisdom can reconcile the fact that there is evil and suffering, even though God is
the source
good
of goodness
and powerful. Maybe there's some kind of divine good purpose behind everything that we're not aware of. Now, you may argue, not aware of? Isn't that a cop-out, Mr. Zordis?
Yeah.
Mr. Hussein? Isn't that a cop-out? Mm. Well, not really, because we're talking about God's wisdom here. And you're never going to know the totality of God's wisdom. If that's the case, either you become God, which is impossible, mm-hmm. right? By virtue of your contingent nature, right? Yeah. Your limited nature. Or you've humanized God, which therefore you've just basically misrepresented mm-hmm. who he really is. Because mm-hmm. his wisdom and knowledge is going to be maximally perfect. He's going to have the totality of knowledge and wisdom. We're going to have fragmentary pieces. Allah's going to have the picture. Mm-hmm. We will just have a pixel. And it's not a cop-out, because we're referring to the nature of God, not the fact of, oh, have we been given particular wisdoms for particular instances of evil or suffering? That's a different discussion. Mm-hmm. We're saying, well, we're talking about who he is, mm-hmm. right? And you attacked first, right? From that point of view. Do you see my point?
Yes, yeah.
So we're saying, well, he's wise. Now, you're not saying, oh, I don't know the wisdom, that's my mm-hmm. problem. Now, that's a different discussion. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem of evil argument anymore. That's a different discussion. And one would argue, by virtue of who God is, you will never know all of God's wisdom anyway. Mm-hmm. Just like, I mean, how is it a cop-out? Let's turn the tables, man. When you go to school or university, do you have access to all of the wisdom of the particular professor? No, you have to work your way up. You have to study. And there's going to be a time where the professor's wisdom is way beyond above yours, or his knowledge is above yours. Bro, this is basic epistemology, basic study of knowledge. Dr. Elizabeth Fricker, she basically says that given that she has limitations, she's not going to know everything. Mm-hmm. Right, she has to refer to the authority of others. Like when I'm on a plane and the pilot says, you know, we're going to have severe turbulence, sit down and buckle up. I'm not going to say, what does he know? Yeah, I don't like turbulence. Yeah, I'm not going to say, what does he know? I'm going to basically do a moonwalk on the aisle. Mm-hmm. No, I'm going to listen to him by virtue of his authority, because he has wisdom and knowledge that I cannot access. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about turbulence. I know it's to do with pressure and stuff. That's it, right? What about when I go to a doctor and I give my symptoms and they say, you have to take this medicine? I don't say, what do you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not a medical practitioner. I don't know the molecular structure of that particular compound. Why am I challenging them? I have to refer to them by virtue of their wisdom and authority or knowledge as beyond mine. So it's not a cop-out. We do it in our day-to-day life all the time.
Yeah, and you wouldn't put yourself in the position where you wouldn't take the medicine and argue, oh, until I understand the reasons behind taking this medicine, I'm not going to take
it. Absolutely.
That'll be stupidity.
Of course, it'll be stupid. But what's interesting here as well, that we have to understand we have epistemic limits. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're trying to understand God's knowledge and wisdom, we are epistemically limited.
Yes.
If we are epistemically limited in a human sense, there are other people with knowledge that we can't access, and we could never know all knowledge because, you know, domains of knowledge have increased and progressed so far that you'd have to spend 50 lifetimes to capture all of that knowledge. So if we're epistemically limited in a human context, then imagine with the divine.
Case in point, pretty much. I think that
Let me summarize it in this way. Yeah. They would have to prove that God's wisdom is logically incompatible with the evil and suffering in the universe.
Wow. So we'll leave that challenge for the comment section of the video.
It's absolutely impossible. But so the secondary assumption.
On that particular point, I think in your book you mentioned, referring to the individuals that take this position and say, look, what do you mean wisdom? I can't see the wisdom. As a type of egocentrism.
Nice, I like
right?
that.
So it shows I've read your book, right? But what do you mean? Can you just clarify that particular point? What were you trying to suggest there?
Well, why I was arguing is that I really believe that the problem of evil argument is genuine for many people because they just don't understand why there's even a suffering, and they have genuine humanistic impulses. So Professor Bernard Schweizer, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, he wrote a book called Hating God, The Untold Story of Misotheism. Miso means hatred in Greek, theos, theism means God, right? So The Untold Story of Misotheism, and he is published by Cambridge, I think it's Cambridge, and he basically says that these people, these misotheists, people who believe in a creator but hate God because of evil and suffering in the world, they begin by having genuine humanistic impulses, which is fine. So it's based on a genuine humanistic impulse, empathy, sympathy, right? Compassion. But what they do now is they get consumed by that to a level where it gets mixed with the ego, if you like, and they think now that my way of seeing and understanding things is the only way. And that's egocentrism. It's a cognitive bias that your way of seeing things is the only way. So what do? They now say, well, God has to feel what I'm feeling. He has to understand the evil and suffering the way I understand the evil and suffering. He has to, you know, see it and understand it from my perspective. And that's where they fail.
They
fall into the kind of abyss and quagmire of egocentrism because they basically humanize God from that point of view, because they are saying this: I can't understand why there's even no suffering in the world. I could never even fathom, you know, or comprehend why a child will have to go through this suffering, or why there's so much famine and war, and it's just, you know, life kicks you in the mouth, it's full of suffering. I can't understand this. It doesn't make any sense. Right? Mm-hmm. So what they'd say is basically, well, God now has no reasons in a way. Or they basically think that God, fine, he may exist, but then there's something wrong with him now because I don't understand.
Yeah.
So what we have to appreciate here is it's not that God wants even a suffering to happen. He just sees something that we don't. He has a wisdom and knowledge. He has wisdom and knowledge that we don't have. And that's what we just have to appreciate. Yeah. So egocentrism, hopefully I've explained that properly, but egocentrism is a cognitive bias that the only way of seeing things is your own way.
Do you think that...
So that's why they're saying, I can't see the reason for evil and suffering in the world. Whoever's done this evil and suffering is evil themselves. So what they've done now is they said, well, since they believe that perspective is the only perspective because they have egocentrism, then God must be evil. And God is an accomplice to evil.
Right.
And he must be fought against, right? That's what misotheism is.
But
basically,
don't you think in that whole process they lose that sort of intuitive understanding that, hold on, the one that gave me compassion and mercy and that I'm expressing right now surely must be more merciful than I am.
Yeah, if they do believe in a creator, then obviously...
Because that's who they're challenging.
He's so the creator of love. He's the source of love. He's the source of compassion. Yeah. He must be more loving and compassionate than I am. Agreed, but that's the problem here. The problem here is they misunderstand God's nature. Right. So they're basically saying that my perspective is the only perspective. I can't find any reason why there's even a suffering in the world, and whoever's done this must be evil. Mm. And since they're saying this perspective is the only perspective because they have egocentrism, then they say, well, God must be evil and he's an accomplice to evil. And this is a cognitive bias. Right. They can't say, maybe God sees something that we don't. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is a divine wisdom. They don't entertain that. Because they can't see it themselves, they can't explain it themselves, and they're really upset. And this, for them, is the only way of seeing things. Mm. That's what egocentrism basically dictates, that your way of understanding something is the only way, it's the only perspective. And therefore, if you come to the conclusion that there's no reason, there's no wisdom, and whoever's done this is evil, then they're basically saying that God is evil.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. You made that really clear. Quickly moving on to the second assumption. What is the second assumption?
Yeah, that God hasn't given us any good reasons why there's evil and suffering in the world. But he has. Life's a test.
So,
and you're going to be tested with evil and suffering.
Okay.
Simple as that. And there's many other reasons in the Quran and the prophetic traditions I ask everybody to explore. I think this essay is on my website that you can explore further.
I'll link it in the description.
And there are many other good books, Muslim and non-Muslim, that address this topic really
well. Why do you think many of the atheists fall into the trap of thinking or assuming that God has created them in this life to be a type of paradise?
Well, they haven't. Well, they don't even believe in God in the first place.
No, but it's like you said, it's the second assumption, right? Which is that they don't believe God has any good reasons to permit evil and suffering. Hence, in a way, assuming that this life should be just perfect without any flaws or imperfections.
Yeah, I mean, that's because it's linked to the first one as well. Because if God is wise, then there are reasons and wisdoms for why there's evil and suffering.
I'm trying to figure out, why is it? Why do you think
that? Well, they're assuming the default position has to be all bliss.
Yeah, but
or at least much less suffering.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Or suffering to the extent where they can comprehend and they can rationalize.
Yes, yeah.
That's because they are auto-deists.
What's an auto-deist?
An auto-deist is they somehow worship themselves. From the point of view that, well, you know, my rational faculties, my reason, right? What I believe, is the reference point. It's the only way.
Okay.
And since I can't understand this, or no, what am I saying? I've lost my track of thought now. Trail of thought. What was I saying?
So auto-deist.
Yeah, but why did I say that before?
You mentioned it because I asked you.
What were you asking?
What I was asking is, why do you think they assume this life should be better than it actually pans out to be sometimes, or it should pan out as they expect it to pan out?
No, I don't remember. But anyway, they're auto-deist by virtue of the fact that they almost worship their reason and they worship their perspective, and they seem to be not willing to believe that there is a higher wisdom and a higher intelligence, if you like, that has knowledge and wisdom about even a suffering that you can't access, but yet make sense of the world. So from that point of view, they just can't appreciate that, which is a bit self-defeating, because the whole point of continuing on your path of knowledge is to have that humility and appreciate that there is another being, even if it's the same species, like another human being, that is far more intelligent and wise than me. Now, by greater reason, God is going to be more intelligent and wise than you. So that's why I call them auto-deists from that point of view. You're just worshipping your own rational faculties. Right. They're limited. And you can't say, just because you can't explain it and it's, you know, you're overwhelmed by emotion, it doesn't mean now that God doesn't have a wisdom and knowledge behind these things. But you know what's very interesting as well? It's for me, and this is a general point, and it's not a strong intellectual point, but I think there's something there. You know, when you travel the world and you go to like places that, you know, developing countries, and people are poor and they go through suffering. Some people have a meal every 2 days or once a day, or even worse, war-torn countries. These people many times get closer to God. Isn't it interesting? Yeah. And the ones on YouTube and Facebook, right, in the middle class, upper middle class living room, they're the one with the problem. And for me, you know what it is? It is auto-deism, like they want to throw the dice. That's what that's what it is. They want to throw the dice because they don't have control, because they're so egocentric, so egotistical, that I am the master of myself and my destiny. I can't have a master above me. Well, your problem is not an intellectual one, as we've just shown. It's more of an emotional one, really. They want to throw the dice, bro. That's what it is. Isn't it interesting? Yeah. But isn't it interesting? Yeah, people go through war, poverty, you know, they find meaning in their life.
They seem to figure things out. They put things in perspective.
They figure things out. Many. Yeah, obviously we have people who go through struggles and trials for sure, and they can't deal with it. But generally speaking, many of these people who have faced a lot of evil and suffering, they deal with it. And they believe in God and they get closer to God. But these YouTubers or philosophers or so-called thinkers who really, in the grand cosmic scheme of things, haven't suffered a day in their life. They're like, oh my God, you know, God doesn't exist. It's because you want to throw the dice, bruv. You know,
But it reminds me of Sam Harris's book, Waking Up. There's a section in there where he complains about a leak in his home,
really?
Which keeps reoccurring, and it's almost a point of suffering for him that he's trying to get across. And someone referred back to that and said he couldn't think of a more sort of real life meaningful example than a tap leak, basically.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, and that just shows, it sort of reflects upon the point you're saying, that we have it easy and we complain about trivial things.
Some people just want to throw the dice. They want to control the dice. They don't want God to control things.
Yeah. So okay, let's move on to what's actually, I think, going to be more beneficial now. So you've just mentioned now, based on the second assumption, that look, this life...
By the way, I have to make a general point that this in no way undermines people's genuine suffering. Or, you know, even people who start to question God and because they suffered a lot in their life, it's not to undermine those experiences in any shape or form. We're making a kind of general intellectual argument here that the argument against God or undermining God's existence by virtue of illness and suffering really doesn't logically follow. And it's based on two daring assumptions. But on a personal level, when you're dealing with someone, you're not going to start saying, oh, you know, you don't believe in God because your son's disabled and you've been taking care of your son for 18 years. How dare you? You're so unintellectual. You're an auto-deist. You are an egocentric person. No, you're not going to do that. You can't speak to people like that. We're making a general point here. But when it comes to one-to-one interaction, you have to listen with the intention to understand. You have to empathize. Mm-hmm. You have to connect with them. And you just have to sometimes be very, very good listeners or, you know, provide help, get them help. If it might be counseling, might be other friends and family.
Yes.
And you need to take them on that journey, and when you're ready, to show them the intellectual position here that even though you've suffered so much, it doesn't undermine God's existence and the fact that he's worthy of worship. And you could start to show them the powerful nature of the Islamic tradition, where the spiritual tools in Islam allow us to transcend suffering from the point of view that we give a different meaning to suffering, and that allows us to cope better.
Right, brilliant. So bro, let's wrap this up, but like I said, give us Islamic perspective. You said, look, the assumption is that there's no good reasons for God to permit evil and suffering. Well, there is. God created this life as a test.
Yes,
right?
And that God is not only good and powerful, he's also the wise and the knowing.
So understanding that, and I'm sure people can pick up a copy of the Quran, read it for themselves and understand the real philosophy of life, if you like. What's life really all about? But you mentioned tools in the beginning, that Islam gives you tools, practical tools that you can implement and use in your day-to-day life, throughout life, which will help you, if you like, navigate the stormy seas of
difficulties
and life itself. Yep. Give us some practical tools, bro. Because we're talking to people, and most people in this world, they don't have these tools, and they can't deal with
these
things.
A lot of these tools are contingent on belief, right? But nevertheless, for example, look, in the grand cosmic scheme of things, right, this is the first kind of conceptual tool, if you want to call it that, or theological tool. You have a life that's full of suffering, and you're a Muslim, and you die. So you go to paradise. I know it sounds really weird, but that's true. This is a fact. And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said in a prophetic tradition, and I'm paraphrasing, that someone who is destined for paradise and they suffered a whole lifetime and they were dipped in paradise for a moment, they will be asked, did you ever suffer? And they would say, by God, I've never suffered, right? So there's light at the end of the tunnel for everyone, right? If you believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and you worship him, there's always light at the end of the tunnel, right? So that gives you hope. And hope is very powerful. We are creatures of hope, bro. So hope is a very powerful tool in order to, you know, transcend suffering from that point of view. Another way of looking at it is we'll give the right meaning to suffering. Because sometimes we give meaning to suffering. And that meaning is the meaning that makes us suffer even more. For example, and God forbid, I wouldn't want this to happen to anybody. Say your daughter passes away. Right, God forbid, my Lord, protect and preserve your family. Yeah, you could start giving the wrong type of meaning, like, oh my God, I've lost the best thing in my life. I'm not going to be the same person. You get into depression. You start blaming everybody. You start hating on people. You start crying every day, which is, these are all natural things, mm-hmm. generally speaking. But you basically can't see the bigger picture. The meaning that you give to it is, life is pointless. Life is full of suffering. There was no point in her dying. Why did this have to happen to me? That's the kind of meaning you're giving to this suffering that you've faced in your life. But what you can do is give the Islamic meaning, right? Give God's meaning to suffering, which is, you know what, Imran? You know the one that created your child that was a gift for you and that he just took back, and that he owns us and owns her as well. And he just took her back. He basically, and that love that you had for your daughter, he is the source of that love. Imagine how loving he is. This test that he gave you is because he loves you. Yeah. And if you react appropriately to this test, then you're going to go paradise forever and your daughter's going to be waiting for you. Right? You see my point? There's more to it than that. But it is a different type of meaning you give to even suffering. It doesn't mean you're not going to cry. It doesn't mean you're not going to be upset. It doesn't mean you're not going to even maybe be in fluctuating in depression here and there, contextual type of depression. But you're giving it a divine meaning that allows you to transcend your suffering. You don't fall into the pit of despair. And that is very powerful. Even in cognitive science, they talk about these things. There's like 4 or 5 strategies or benefits of suffering and evil, right? Now, if you add the Islamic theological and spiritual aspects to these things, it helps you to float, you know, to navigate the stormy seas of life. So, I mean, you give me some.
Yeah, no, so I was just, when you mentioned those points, I was reminding me of the Prophet peace be upon him. Because the Prophet suffered too. Islam gives you, it puts things into perspective, but it gives you the tools to be able to navigate life properly, right? And at the end of the day, like you're saying, it's one way of looking at it, it's a dream that you're going to wake up from. Right, and dreams don't last. They may be difficult, they may be nightmares sometimes, but when you wake up the next day and within a few hours it's gone.
Yes.
Right. So that is something very powerful, and I think that's something people are missing. People don't have these tools. They can't even think of these. And one other thing I was thinking of when you were mentioning those points, really think of it from a naturalist perspective.
Yeah, I was going to pull something out actually.
Because I was just thinking that, you know, this whole thing, this reaction you expressed, which was, why is this happening to me? It shouldn't have happened to me. Why does she have to die? These questions shouldn't even really make sense for someone that's a naturalist.
Yeah.
Because it's all just me. It's all a meaningless.
Well, you know what? There's a really, really powerful. Do I need glasses? I hope I don't. Bear with me.
Who would like to see Hamza in glasses? Leave it in the comments below.
There you go. So basically, let me find this for you, bro, because I think it was very, very powerful. Just bear with me. Problem.
Apparently, while you're looking for it, Darwin himself, Sabur mentioned it a while back, Darwin himself lost his faith in God when his daughter died.
Yeah, these are tests. But this is why it's very important to be connected to the divine. And the way to connect to the divine is understand who he is, what's his names and attributes, and to worship him as he deserves to be worshipped. Those two things have to come together. And then when you face the tests and trials of life, then you could sail through them. You could ride the stormy waves. But if you basically have a false notion of the divine, that he's just a loving creator and that's it.
Who's created this paradise?
Yeah, and then when life hits you in the face, what are you going to do? But if you don't understand Allah is that, you know, the wise, the knowing, he is the subtle, he is the source of goodness, he is, and all of these names and attributes, and you worship him and you glorify him and you praise him, then these things come together that help you basically, you know, withstand the trials of life. But yeah, that's why one would argue that I think it's affected the Christian tradition more than the Islamic tradition, because the Christian tradition, although they do believe in a wise God, I don't want to, you know, dismiss them and misrepresent the Christian tradition, but there was a heavy focus on divine love, which is a great thing because, you know, Allah's name is the loving, Al-Wudud, right? Which means, comes from the Arabic word wud, which means a loving that is giving. He's excessively loving. But they wouldn't talk about the true divine reality as, you know, as who he is, because he's not only the loving, but he's also the merciful, and he's the wise, and he's the knowing, and all of these other things. So let me just find this thing for you. So there you go. This is a quote, right? This was from one of our specialist seminars. And I have to give you the contrast between a naturalistic position. Bear with me. Here you go. All right. Theism or atheism, natural, or in this sense, philosophical naturalism, which is the view that there is no divine, no supernatural. Everything could be explained by physical processes. So contrast these two positions, right? You ready? Mm-hmm. On the contrary, if the universe were just electrons and selfish genes, meaningless tragedies like the crashing of this bus are exactly what we should expect, along with equally meaningless good fortune. Such universe would neither be neither evil nor good in intention. It would manifest no intentions of any kind. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no good and no evil. Nothing but blind, pitless indifference. Who said this?
Our Professor Dawkins.
Professor, right? Richard Dawkins in his book, River Out of Eden. Now contrast this with a potential Muslim response. Your pain and suffering will be rewarded with eternal bliss in paradise. If you suffered for a whole lifetime and you were dipped in paradise for a moment, you would feel that you never suffered. Even suffering exists to test you, elevate you, and facilitate a higher spiritual state. It is meant to bring you closer to the divine, therefore closer to paradise. As a believer, any pain or suffering is a means to absolve you from your shortcomings and sins. When you are tested with evil and suffering, it is a sign of divine love. For he knows you have the ability to overcome the trials in your life. He knows you better than you know yourself. So you see the contrast. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the existential, spiritual, theological tools, it's summarized in these 2 points. Mm-hmm. One's pitless indifference, no evil, no good, khalas, get over it. The other one is, well, you know what? There is a divine meaning behind this, even in suffering. And the way to adopt the divine meaning is to really connect with him continuously. And if you know Allah and you worship him, the meaning that he gives to us concerning evil and suffering is the meaning that we'd adopt, not as some, okay, I'll adopt your ideas kind of thing, but it will become part of who we are. So we will respond to evil and suffering the way Allah wants us to respond to evil and suffering. Yeah. But yeah. So
I think you've summarized that really well. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
We need to be very careful to navigate these emotional situations, because people suffer and there's evil and suffering in the world, and it's genuine, and people genuinely suffer. And, you know, if you engage with your brother and sister in humanity and they have doubts in God, or they reject God or religion because of suffering that you can never even empathize because you've never experienced it yourself, you need to relax. You can't start having intellectual dialogue saying, oh, you're incoherent, you know, God is also the wise, and you have to show, the onus of proof is on you to show that, you know, God's wisdom is logically incompatible with evil and suffering in the universe. No, you can't. That you won't connect with them. With people like this, you need to connect with them, and if they need genuine help, you need to take them to professionals, of course. Yeah. So I'm saying you have to be very careful the way you basically articulate this. So this was a general point. Problem with evil doesn't make, it's not an argument, it's based on 2 false assumptions, and we've shown why they're false, and also, you know, we have the spiritual tools in place to deal with this. Now, we didn't go into detail of all of these things and the other nuances. I would humbly suggest go to my website, hamzadzorgis.com. You could read the article, Is God Good, or Is God Merciful?
I'll link it in anyway.
Description. Link it in. And there's other things to read.
Also, the second edition of your, or the newly revised edition of your book is going to be out soon.
It's on Amazon.
Revised
edition. Yeah,
you can pick that up and you can read that too, because that there's a whole chapter in that particular book on this topic and more. It's touched upon other chapters as well.
It's on the first revision too. Okay, so I don't think I changed the problem of evil chapter at all. So it's still there. Okay. And plus, it's free on my website.
Okay, so it's there, or you can buy the physical copy, because there's a lot more good stuff in there for you guys to read too. So we'll wrap up on that. If you guys have any questions, any ideas, any views, anything you'd like to share, please comment in the comment section below. Make sure to subscribe and share. And until next time, take care.